We might just give it 60 seconds to start, just in case it's in that direction.
Well, thanks everyone for coming along to this Parliamentary Library seminar on electioneering and social media. It's probably a very hot topic, I suppose, and it's good to see there's a large turnout here. But we go through all the different social media, your Facebook, your Twitter, YouTube, I mean, it's all up there, the LinkedIn and Flickr. They can be one of the best tools for a politician, but they can also be a trap for the unwary, I suppose, too. And I think I've got three out of that five. I'm still getting the hang of Twitter myself. I keep on getting invites to LinkedIn and I'm staying away, so maybe we can hear a bit about that. And Flickr's all about photos, so and I'm not good on the camera. But look, my job here today is just to introduce to you our two guest speakers. We've got Professor Jim McNamara from UTS in Sydney and Dr. Jason Wilson from the University of Canberra. Just to introduce Professor McNamara, we'll speak first. Yes, okay. Just to give a brief introduction for Professor McNamara and his talk, he's going to introduce his findings from a study of elected representatives' use of new media in the 2010 federal election, presenting an overview of who is doing what and the directions of change. And obviously, as said, we'll be joined by Dr. Wilson, who will explore in detail the question of social media and the role that it plays in contemporary Australian political practice, asking what value that it actually holds for practitioners. But to give a brief introduction to Professor McNamara, Jim McNamara has had a distinguished 30-year career working in professional communications practice spanning journalism, PR, advertising and media research. Before joining UTS, he was the CEO of a leading strategic communication consultancy, Macro Communication, for 13 years, working with clients that included Microsoft, Vodafone, the Business Software Association of Australia and Singapore Airlines, before he founded and headed the Asia Pacific office of the world's leading media research company, Karma International, for a decade. In 2006, he sold that company to Media Monitors and was appointed Group Research Director responsible for Australia, New Zealand and Asia. In addition to his scholarly writings, he's the author of 11 professional books and is a regular international speaker at conferences and seminars in the US, UK and Asia on communication and media, and particularly the new media. So without any further ado, I'll introduce Professor Jim McNamara.
Thank you all. Good afternoon. Very quick visit to Canberra. I'm in and out. But it's always good to come along and talk about some research. I'm going to share with you bits from two research studies. One, the last federal election, looking at what some of our candidates did, as well as the parties, and also some previous research on various departments and agencies involved in online citizen consultation to try and look at what I call not only elections, but politics in peacetime, as it were. Now, when we come to social media, there's no denying, there's a lot of cyber optimism out there, or cyberbole, as some call it. Some are citing this as the change of the whole world, it's all going to be perfect. And yet, if you've only got to spend a few hours or a few minutes on Twitter, and to find out what people are buying in their groceries, they've been to the supermarket, what they had for breakfast, a lot of it's not exactly life-changing stuff. So let's just be really honest about this. You know, there's a lot of, you know, someone said YouTube, the motto is broadcast yourself. Twitter, the motto should be how you can make a twit of yourself. In the midst of all that, though, we've then got other things happening around the world that really make us stop and think. We saw what happened in Iran. We saw social media used to organise major democracy movements when mainstream media were shut down. More recently, Egypt. And I love this photo of, you know, the ultimate citizen journalist. There he is with his mobile phone, and he's photographing as the riots are occurring, and there's no media allowed in the streets, and this photo is being sent back to the New York Times and goes around the world. We saw in Japan officials acknowledging social media playing a very real and very significant part following the earthquake and the tsunami. And of course, as well as the recent Queensland floods, I went to a talk by the Queensland Commissioner of Police, who said that in many cases where voice networks were jammed, that they were relying on text messages, SMS, Twitter, Facebook posts, and so forth, and people using mobile devices. So there's something significant going on out there. There's something significant, albeit I'm not in the camp of those who say everything is changing. So let me quickly just talk a little bit about, you know, this is something I love to research, because I started out as a journalist when we still had hot metal. And I have a big piece of hot metal on my shelf in my office, just to remind me. It's a date slug from 1974, during the printer's strike at the Sydney Morning Herald. The 2010 election, very interesting one. If anyone's interested in reading, this is about to come out in the next, my analysis and research findings are about to come out in the next issue of Media International Australia. It was very different to this election. I'll give you some comparative data, because I also tracked the 2007 federal election when we saw that John Howard enter YouTube for the first time. Remember that amazing speech where he said, "Good morning," and only be told that there is no morning on the internet, it's 24/7. The Labor Party did a far better job with Kevin 07. Kevin 07 was sort of seen as a bit of a landmark campaign. But most of the researchers found, when they actually analysed it, that it was in fact a very controlled campaign, a very branded campaign, and not a lot of interactivity in that campaign, albeit it broke some new ground. So what I did in 2010, I did a content analysis, I did quant and qual, and I'll give you some highlights of both. I wanted to know the numbers and the types of social media being used. We looked at every blog post, Facebook, friend, like, wall post, comment, Twitter, we looked at followers, following, types of tweets, etc. YouTube uploads, views, you name it, and also specialist channels like Labor Connect and Think Tank. So we collected a lot of data. Now, I would have liked to have done every candidate, but we just couldn't do that, so we focused on the re-standing MPs and senators. So we ended up with this, with the 206 in the sample. 20 were not re-standing, plus we did the two major political parties. That still gave us a very large sample. In the qualitative, we then took the top 10 most frequent tweeters, having done the quant work, and the most liked and befriended Facebook users from that sample, and we did detailed qualitative coding of exactly what they tweeted about and what they said, and etc., and I'll give you a little bit of that. Here's an overview, and I know it's a lot of numbers, but just the bold and the red will give you the key facts. Apart from websites, which most politicians have, Twitter and Facebook, you can see, are the big movers, hence the bolding. So Twitter did exist in 2006, but it was not used in the 07 election, 07, 2010, but really grew rapidly. Facebook is huge growth. Kevin 07 was talked about, but only 8 federal MPs had a Facebook page site in 2007, much less than we sometimes think. MySpace, of course, is changed its whole format. It's become more of a specialist site, so not surprisingly, it's died. Flickr's grown. E-surveys, e-petitions. We looked at a very wide range of electronic engagement or digital engagement. Overall, though, we saw more than doubling of social media use by our federal politicians during the 07 to 010 campaign. So looking at those big movers, Twitter, 45%, 92 of our federal re-sitting MPs were on Twitter. You would have noticed some of these during the campaign, including our Prime Minister, but 4% were fake sites. They were not the MP. Very interestingly, though, almost all of them outed in a very short time. which tells us something interesting about, you know, the issue of credibility comes up. But it was funny how quickly people could identify the fake sites. I'll interpret if you can't read the names at the bottom. This is the top 20 most active politicians on Twitter. And this absolute standout performer in volume, Malcolm Turnbull. 439 tweets. By the way, I should have mentioned my sample period was the final 3 weeks of the campaign. So just in 3 weeks, 439 tweets, Scott Morrison, Andrew Robb, Bert Lundy, Cormann, through Julia Gillard at 9, and Hanson Young, a Green Senator at number 10. That's your top 10. This comes out in several places in the research. No real political party skew. Even there, you see, I think, 5 Lib, 4 Labour, 1 Green. And that was fairly common. It was sometimes 4 Labour, 5 Liberal. Pretty much proportional by party. What you don't see in that list is Tony Abbott, because that was his total tweeting during the election. In fact, that's his total tweeting from July to the post-election, and he only had 3 tweets during the campaign. Very quickly on volume, Facebook page likes. Blue is liking of an official page, red is a friending. What you see immediately, not probably surprisingly, most of the political leaders have community pages and you could only like them, you couldn't become a friend. Particularly in the case with the Prime Minister and Kevin Rudd, who dominated. Then I took those out because that was the whole leadership switch. And if you pull them out, you see that apart from the Prime Minister and the former Prime Minister, you've got Bob Brown, Tony Abbott, again, mostly community pages. But what you do see, compared to the previous slide, is you can see actually a lot of the MPs do actually take friends into Facebook, whereas the leaders had it only for their personal sites. Probably more interesting and getting slightly more qualitative though, to move on, is followers and following, because it's not a precise measure, but followers, of course, every politician wants supporters. But following is listening. It's you want to listen and engage with other people. So we thought that was an interesting number to compare. And red is following, blue is the number of followers. And you'll see, of course, two again standouts, Malcolm Turnbull and Julia Gillard, in terms of the number of followers and following. Always the number of followers higher. But actually, these two, which I'll give you the numbers on in a moment, surprisingly interested in following other people. Now, we're not naive. We don't think that either Malcolm Turnbull or Julia Gillard were personally reading every one of those thousands and thousands of people they were following. I don't have a problem with that, because even if they're staff and monitoring, it still is they're going to be advising those people, so in some way that is engaging with the community. Here's just some of the numbers though to make it a bit more specific. You see Malcolm Turnbull quite surprisingly balanced. Still more followers, but following 20,498 people at the same time as he had 26,000 followers. That, unfortunately, was not the normal story. That was the exception. What you see more typically is, you know, a couple of thousand followers for Scott Morrison, and he and his staff were only following 166. Much the same. Even the younger politicians still, there was no age skew. The old guys were doing as good as the young guys, which was interesting. The young, we broke out all the young politicians, and they were not the best users of social media. And Tony Abbott, I put him in, he was number 92 on the list, but he had 20,000 followers, and he and his staff were following 20. Now, Twitter's not the only environment I know, but to me that does say something. If you go into Twitter, it's a two-way medium. If you're looking for followers, but you're not following anyone else, it's the same thing as saying, I'm not really interested in what you guys have got to say. I want you to be interested in what I've got to say. Then I'll go further, and we've got into the types of tweeting, and you'll see this trend continuing. So we coded by about 15 categories, and I've just put 4 here. We coded whether they were responses or broadcasts, so were they responding to an individual, at Jim McNamara or whoever. So we put in the number of where am I's, because that's a very common type of tweeting. I'm at the supermarket, I'm about to go on the ABC. And we put in here attacks on our opponents. So I'm just showing you 4 of the coding categories. Malcolm Turnbull, again, fairly surprisingly, of his 439 tweets, the majority were actually responses to other individuals responding about something, direct messages, which was really, really quite interesting. But again, it was the absolute anomaly. Scott Morrison, the second most prolific tweeter, he had 33 responses but 125 broadcast tweets. And my old friend Andrew Robb, Andrew was the economist at the National Farmers Federation in 1980 when I was the head of public affairs. So we worked together for 4 years there. Andrew, I'm sorry to say, doesn't get social media. He had 141 broadcasts and he had one direct message to somebody. What was also interesting is 79 of his broadcasts were direct personal attacks on the opposition, mostly Julia Gillard. You can contrast that with Julia Gillard, who also had more broadcasts than responses, but only had four attacks actually on opponents. She mostly talked about policy issues. So some of the things that came out is that a huge amount of the tweeting and the Facebook work was not about policy issues. A lot of it was slagging off the opposition. It was more broadcasting than it was responding to individuals, and it was more follow me, I'm not interested in following any of you. And that was sort of, that's generalising it, but that was the overall pattern. Now, I don't want to even go through this, but just to draw out 2 points about the political parties. Labour did, we put huge amounts of analysis into this, but Labour did use Labour TV a lot, and some significant numbers there, 32 videos. They also had these specialised sites. They went more away from Facebook, more to specialist sites. If you looked at Liberal, they relied mainly on Facebook and didn't do much on video. But the other thing I wanted to show you these two screens for is that that's a reasonably large number, but look at most of these numbers. This is important to bear in mind. I'm all for social media. I'm very enthusiastic about it. But we have to be honest, these are not large numbers. With a country of 11 million adults, these are not big, big numbers. These are not in the league of the Sydney Morning Herald or the Australian or the etc. So it's just important to, a lot of important discussion may have happened here, but it's interesting to know that even some of the best videos only had a few thousand views. So when we talk about the Australian electorate and engaging with Australian citizens, I think that's, social media is still a relatively small part of the public sphere. So the sort of conclusions I draw out of that before I quickly just summarise the other bit of research is we're talking a lot about the democratisation of the public sphere. There's no question the fact that now not just the political actors of journalists and politicians can speak is important. There is a democratisation. But the characteristics of Web 2, the characteristics of social media, is it's meant to be social. It's meant to be two-way. And these are just fundamental principles. It's meant to be about dialogue. It's meant to be about conversations. It's meant to be about openness. These are fundamental principles. You can go back and read the founders like Tim O'Reilly and Peter Merholz who created Web 2. They said these were the key principles. That's why it's social media. So my concern about this is we're in the early stages of what might be a revolution, but the focus is on the technologies and we're not changing the practices. We are taking the practices of all styles of political communication, the practices of mass communication and mass media into the new media. And to me, it's about looking at the way we practice communication because communication is actually a two-way process. And so that's one of my key concerns, and it's really the theme of the book that I wrote last year was about, the subtitle is Emergent Communication Practices. We've embraced the technology, but we've not embraced the practices. How much time have I got? 5 minutes. Just want to quickly move away then from elections, and we can ask questions about that if you like. I mean, overwhelmingly, it was dominant broadcast, transmissional messages, stop the votes, etc. Let's look at politics in peacetime, though, because elections are a hotspot. And I did do research previous to this, looking at the whole area of e-government is more about service delivery, but we have seen this huge growth in what some call e-democracy, the idea of using these social media, not just for electioneering, but to engage with citizens in consultation, in the policy processes, etc. And there's been a whole history around most countries now looking at this. I think the UK and Canada led for a while, reports like this one. Then the UK Power of Information Task Force was a very significant move in 2009, which of course then triggered our Government 2.0 Task Force that brought in a number of changes. What I did in 2009 was looked at in-depth interviews with 11 federal government departments and agencies that were involved in some form of social media for online consultation. We talked to policy people, IT people and communication staff. We think that's significant. We also at the same time did a content analysis of what they were doing online. And I won't put all of them up, but these are some of the sites. Some of them were official trials. The online human rights consultation was done. Bacardi, I think the nickname is Bacardi's blog on digital economy. And then through to even organisations like the War Memorial that are using the commons for photographic and library work, etc. We also did some participation. We had a number of people, research assistants, going in and participating in some of these to look at the navigation, etc. I'll just quickly summarise the findings. I think these are really important because I think they tell us what we might have to look at doing. First thing we found is lack of planning. And it wasn't necessarily the fault. There was a lot of passion for doing this, but very often it was in one case it was the minister announced that there would be a blog before anyone in the department knew there would be a blog. So when we asked them, how did you plan it, they said, well, we just had to start doing it. There was no planning of even whether a blog, in fact, was the right tool. And probably it wasn't. And that's very common in the corporate world, by the way. You say to Optus, why do you use social media? And they say, because Telstra is. And it's actually they're serious. Hijacking is a definite risk. Whenever you do something online to discuss a particular issue, the digital economy blog at Communications was a good example. It was meant to be on digital economy. Of course, Clean Feed was happening around the same time, and that whole site got taken over. So lobbyists and interest groups can take over. Some of the other serious ones, response time. Response time expectations online, of course, are very different to the physical world. And there was a real struggle in many of these sites to be able to have the resources and the tools to be able to respond to people in any sort of, not only the regulatory issues as well. Poor design and navigation in some cases, especially where they were given out to third parties or put behind heavy firewalls, it was actually difficult, and particularly when the IT, sorry, any IT people in the room, but if the IT people run the show, they were usually not very friendly. And that's why we talked to policymakers, communication people and IT people, and we concluded there's got to be a coordination of all three. Lack of resources. Most of the departments we talked to and the agencies were actually quite enthusiastic and some very committed people, but they were not given any additional staff or any additional equipment to do these online consultations. And of course, if it's popular, if you are successful and you start getting thousands of comments, there's a lot of work to be done. And there was no resourcing put behind it. There were some culture barriers, and this was also confirmed in the UK, in the public service there. Language barriers, and I don't mean English. Moderation. When you get into online consultation, people don't write like they're writing a government submission, something to be prepared for. They don't even write like a ministerial. People put in smileys. People use F words. People put in, they wanted to vote on policies with a thumb up, thumb down. Most of the moderation policies, the machines wouldn't read it, or it was moderated out. And so a big learning around the world, and this came out of the Obama campaign, talking to those guys, is that if you go into online consultation in a broader environment, you've got to let people talk in the language they talk about, and the way they talk on social media, and they use voting tools, they use frowns, smileys, they use language like shit, and if you're moderating that out or not treating it as serious, you actually eliminate a large part of the comment. And I don't know, I thought the economy is shit is actually a fairly good, well-grounded submission. There was also a focus on, most of the government agencies only looked at government-hosted sites, and the security and all those issues were cited, but the reality is a huge amount of the conversation is happening on other sites. And if you really want to listen, you've not only got to have your sites, you've got to fish where the fish are, to use an old cliche. And in the UK, there's been great examples like government wants to engage with young women and mothers, but actually NetMums, a private site, has got 500,000 mothers. So if you want to engage with them, you've got to go to NetMums. It's no use starting a new government site and expecting that they will all come to you. The other big thing, finally, is lack of sense-making tools. This really has come out of the Obama campaign. When you open up the doors to online consultation, if you're unsuccessful, well, that's a problem. But if you are successful, your success is then your own undoing because you get thousands or potentially millions of words. What do you do with it? And human beings just can't read it all. So what the Obama campaign was very successful at is running very fast text analysis software over it, and they were grouping and identifying themes and common topics, and then responding with group messages, not by name, but saying, we know you're all concerned about X. And when they did surveys, they found that people thought they were being responded to because they'd responded to the issue. And in fact, most people were satisfied with that, that they'd heard the message about the issue. And that was very clever to use these sense-making tools rather than try to engage in gimmicky, sort of personalised messages. The tenth finding we found is the sites that worked best is where, both here and overseas, is where we engage with particular communities of interest or communities of practice. Generic sites inviting the whole population seem to not work well, but when you narrow it down, and I shouldn't pick on any favourites, but the War Memorial, posting photographs to try and identify lost soldiers. There was a particular community of interest, and the word spread around the world, and people from all over the world got involved because they shared that sort of bond. And that's the learning of a lot of online sites, is that particular communities of interest, you're better off doing several slices rather than one big online consultation. So what we found there is that there was actually a lot of genuine interest and commitment in doing it, but issues like resourcing, issues like language, issues like the culture, issues like response time, and you definitely need some tools to do this with. Definitely need some tools. And there is actually research happening at MIT in the US where they're really developing argumentation software and tools that take all the online comment and theme it and group it into buckets of different topics so that when people come in, they can actually find where it's up to and then find the bit they want to comment on, and it helps them make sense of it. So that's what we mean by sense-making tools. My conclusion so far that, you know, I would encourage you all to think about engagement with citizens because this is important to our democracy, but we must make no bones about the fact that listening to people, because this is what this is about, this is not about just going out there and talking, which our politicians still seem to think it is another place to talk, that listening is hard work. Listening takes time, takes work. And the second thing that I've started to write about is what I call an architecture of listening. If you analyse any of your organisations, if you analyse even your specialised communication departments, the press secretaries, public affairs, we have an architecture, we build an architecture for talking. Almost all the resources and almost all the software and all the tools and all the staff are for writing press releases, producing brochures, building websites, mostly an architecture of talking. And what we find is, and this is the same in the corporate world, is there is almost no architecture for listening. And by that I mean not only policies and intangibles, but things like tools to analyse the way the Obama campaign was doing, so the culture, the resources, the policies, and the physical tools like databases to hold it, software tools, text analysis tools to group it and theme it, and articulate it back into policy in some way that makes sense. So I think that's one of my key messages, is that it's good to be enthusiastic. Most people seem to be enthusiastic in the sense that our democracy needs more engagement. I've cautioned that the numbers are not big, but there is nevertheless a lot of important conversations happening online. But if you go there, it requires work, and it does require an architecture of listening. Where do we go now? The conversation in peacetime, does it end? It's interesting. I continue tracking the same politicians for 60 days after the election. And even though it was a hung parliament, and you'd expect that they might have stayed active, the conversation went straight away, which again suggests to me they're there to talk, they're there to win government, and once they've achieved, or think they've achieved their objective, the conversation dies. I think the conversation has to continue. The future of government 2.0, as our government calls it, or e-democracy, I think there's a place for it. But I've tried to highlight some of the real practical issues, that these are still not big numbers. This is a part of our public sphere that's online. It's an important part. They are engaged people who want to talk. So I think we have to engage with them. The cost of not engaging with the people who are interested is that they will further disengage in an already fairly disengaged society. So I think there's a compulsion or a compelling reason to engage, but it's hard work. And I think I'll leave it there and say thank you. That's a strong theme of the book that I've recently written.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much for that, Jim. I suppose now we'll go into some questions while that's fresh in everyone's head. We'll go for 10 minutes of questions before we hear from Jason. So if anyone just wants to stand up, put their hand up or whatever, and we'll go. Any question? Yes.
Has there been any analysis done with regards to communication in social media and changing voting patterns?
There's been a little bit. And not probably not surprisingly, because there's been a lot of research into changing behaviour in a lot of areas. And of course, what we all know, if you work in communication, changing behaviour is a very long road and requires multiple influences in most cases. So not surprisingly, there's very little evidence so far that online engagement changes voter behaviour. There's a few little signs that it might influence that. What it is seen to be doing, though, and what the Obama campaign found, not so much the UK election. The UK election was very similar to my results. They've got their results in, and it was mostly talking. But what they are finding is it is successful in getting more people engaged in a conversation. It's doing that. So the optimist would say that's a good start, because if people aren't even talking about politics or policy issues, then you know it's very hard to know what they even think. But no, it's very hard to see the effect. And it's a bit the same if you're trying to promote road safety. Can you actually see the road toll coming down because of what you do? There's a very long road through awareness and attitudinal changes and cultural changes before you see the behavioural change.
There's another question here.
Yeah, it was just a question of clarifying the significance of the reach. Back there, I think I saw a figure on, I think it was Labor TV, said 611,000 views. That seemed like a lot, and yet you were suggesting it was a limited reach. Can you perhaps explain that a bit further?
Yes. I went through it all pretty quickly. That was total views during the three-week period. That's still a significant number, but you would have noticed a lot of them, blogs and posts, were like 3,000-4,000 type views, which are really quite low numbers. The Labor TV was one of the more successful ones. I think I had a highlight over it. But even so, a lot of TV programs and current affairs programs would hope to have a couple hundred thousand in one night. So we're still a long way short of the mass media numbers.
Political content, so that's just pure political content.
Yeah.
So yeah. People are actually going online and looking at political content as distinct from watching a soap.
Yes. Yeah. So I think Labor TV was one I had a highlight on, was one of the more significant things. With the Liberal Party, they used Facebook a lot more and didn't have any proprietary sites. And they used Twitter a fair bit. Labor didn't use Facebook much at all. I think they had 16,000 likers in Facebook. So, I mean, 16,000 likers in a country of our size is not a lot of likers. I mean, a few individuals have got almost that. Your point is perfectly valid. And, of course, when you go in to look at one of those items, you're not just grazing through a newspaper that has multiple stories. You're actually looking at a particular video or a particular message.
The question on the 2007 versus 2010, I assume the demographics have changed dramatically in that period too, as to the age of the users of social media, or who's interacting, or who wants to interact, or has it stayed pretty much the same, or do you know the answer to that?
That's a good question. There's two parts to that. The study I did, I looked at the sitting candidates. So I looked at, I think it was 224 in 2007 and 206, and they were whoever was a sitting member. Their demographics hadn't shifted a lot. But the other part of your question, I think you're implying, is what about the people using it? And I didn't make the point going through, but most of the research is into the supply side of online consultation, what governments and politicians are doing. There's actually very little research into the demand side. What do citizens actually want online? And it's an area that a couple of writers have recently talked about, and there's a little bit of research emerging that suggests that people, a small part of the population, do want to engage with their politicians and policy issues online. And interestingly, they usually don't do it. That's not quite right. They're actually often involved elsewhere. So if you're active, you're active. But there is a lack of information about what most citizens actually want online and how many really want it.
Were the specialist sites such as Labor Connect effective in terms of engaging with particularly the communities that they were trying to protect?
I don't think they were on the numbers, but, you know, they'd have to judge.
In terms of qualitative then?
Qualitative maybe, but I mean, 315 comments there, there were 3,000 members in Labor Connect, relatively small, and I think, you know, you also, some of those will be organised friends that you rally around to get onto your site. We all do it, you know, when you first create your Facebook page, don't you? You contact, email all your friends saying, please befriend me, just so you've got some friends, you don't have to look desperate. So these are relatively small numbers. I think they were interesting initiatives that Labor went that proprietary way, whereas Liberal didn't have that, and they, whereas they had 16,000 likes in Facebook, 3,000 comments, you know, 10 times the number of comments on Labor's Facebook. Oh, sorry, six times.
Do you think it's, were you able to look at whether the member or senator or candidate was posting on Twitter or Facebook themselves, or whether it was a staffer? And do you think it's important either way? And just as an aside, I know I heard someone, a staffer overseas, say in response to the Wiener scandal in the US that they never would allow their boss to have their password to their Twitter account.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'd agree with that. Look, I mean, a lot of my colleagues would disagree with me. Some of the literature I read suggested that having your staff do the monitoring and the tracking and the liking and the posting is fake. I don't know. You'd be the judge, but I think that's a little bit harsh. If you're a minister, you're a busy politician, if you've got staff, they are your advisors. If they are doing the monitoring and the listening, I think that's good. I think that's part of your listening. You're using these, you know, to use a McLuhan term, extensions of man. You can't do it all yourself. And then secondly, if they were posting, I would think they'd be posting within policy. If they were posting things outside of the members or the minister's views, they probably would be in some trouble, I would think. So I don't have a huge problem with it. Could we tell? Not most of the time. I mean, Julia Gillard was the only public one who admitted it, that she did at one stage have people tweeting for her. But then during the campaign, while I was actually watching it, I was following her, and she actually took a photograph on her iPhone in the back of the car and posted it and said, "See, it's me." And I thought that was incredibly human. And that's one of the little benefits. When that happens, that's quite amazing. The amount of discussion that went on in the Twitter sphere when she did that, that it's a human being. And, you know, I think she won a lot of support just by, and Malcolm Turnbull did similar things. Admittedly, he was wrong. Whole wave goes through the Twitter sphere going, "My God, it's a human politician."
For a politician called Randy, you think that'd be the last thing that you would get up to that.
Did you have a chance to look at how people were accessing their social media, whether it's on a PC or on like a handheld device, and whether that impacted on how people were sort of engaging or consuming social media?
Yeah, I didn't get any data on that at all, because remember, we were looking primarily at supply side outgoing, and I really think there needs to be more research on the demand side, how people are accessing. The UK has looked at it, and they found that the demographics of social media users are not just young people. We need to be very clear on that. They're very spread, but the very young use mobile. Not many of the older demographics are using mobile devices for social media. They'll use it for their phone, they might use it for email, but trying to tweet on an iPhone is not that easy if you're over 40.
Can I ask one quick question? You talked about low levels of numbers. Do you see that there will be a rapid growth or a major growth? Is this going to play a much bigger part than it is now, or is it always just going to be an adjunct to the mainstream media?
Yeah, that's really the core question, isn't it? All the evidence there is that, you know, all the evidence through media history is that one media does not replace the previous media. I mean, that happened with cinema, it happened with VCRs, it happened with radio, with TV. The previous media was usually forecast to be wiped out, and wasn't. So if we learn from media history, then we would assume that, you know, I think there's a little bit of adjustment to be done in the newspaper industry and the television industry and probably radio. A lot of serious adjustment to be done, but they will no doubt respond, and they are responding, and they'll find new ways of doing quality journalism and so forth. I think they've got some business model issues, but there's no question this is an important, the numbers of in Facebook, not just in the election campaign, but the numbers overall are really quite large. And when you look at surveys on where people get their information from, there's a very growing percentage of our population that are primarily getting it online and not getting it from radio, TV or press. So if we want to reach those people, we have to be in this space. It's no different, I think, that it's 1920 and radio is invented. You can't stand there and say, we're just going to use newspapers. The politicians had to get on radio. And when TV came in, we saw it with Johnson and campaigns, you had to be on TV. You had to be on TV. We now have to be in this space. But is it the answer? Is it the replacement? I guess my data is suggesting no, it's not. It's an important... There's no one public sphere. There are multiple public spheres. This is another important one. Not big in numbers yet, but very interested, very active people. And those are the very people I think we do want to keep engaged in politics and policy issues.
Thanks very much, Professor McMurray.
To introduce Dr. Jason Wilson, and I was just about to add him onto Facebook because he tells me he comes from hails from Townsville, but he actually lives in Douglas. If he lived just over the other side of the road of that suburb, he'd be in my electorate. But anyway, so I won't send you a friend request, Jason. But Dr. Wilson's an academic, a journalist, and a blogger. Originally from Townsville, Queensland, as I said, he is educated at Australian Catholic University and Griffith University. Dr. Wilson worked at the Research Institute for Media Art and Design at the University of Bedfordshire, was on the editorial team of Convergence, which is the International Journal of Research into New Media Technologies, and was director of eDemocracy at the online campaigning organisation GitHub. From 2007 to 2008, Wilson was project manager and editor at YouDecide 2007, a research project into citizen journalism and the political blogosphere, based at the Queensland University of Technology. He's lectured in digital communications at the University of Wollongong and currently works in journalism and technologies at the University of Canberra. Without any further ado, Dr. Jason Wilson.
Thanks very much. With the weather the way it is, I wish I was up in Dewiston at the moment. That was great, and I think when slagging off the opposition was mentioned, that's kind of my area of research interest, really. I'm interested in dynamics of conflict and competition, not necessarily the warm cuddly stuff, even trolling. I'm sort of interested in trolling, so that's where I'm at. So perhaps my presentation will be a little bit darker than the first one. But look, I'm really honoured to be asked to talk to you here today. I hope I'll make some contribution to your thinking about how all of us, that's advocates, journalists and citizens, might best navigate the rapidly changing media environment. And I hope I'll provide some food for thought, or at least some new questions about where a mediated democracy is going. Despite the billing, I won't be prophesying or evangelising social media today. I'll just offer some observations from the immediate past, and largely they'll be based on observations of the 2010 federal election. I'll introduce a few concepts from my own field of academic research, which is political communication, to talk about how the recent election showed how Australia's political communication system has changed. I'm not here to teach you really to suck eggs regarding campaigning. I take it you guys are the experts there. It's an academic viewpoint. I'm doing detailed research myself at the moment on some things like Twitter faking and trolling. But today, I really want to give some broad remarks regarding the election. Okay, what's a political communication system? Well, it's a way of understanding political communication as the product of a system with independent, mutually adaptive, and sometimes competing elements. That's my key message. This is what a political communication system looked like for most of the 20th century. Okay? That diagram comes from Brian McNair's book, Introduction to Political Communication, which is what we give to our first year students. And for a lot of people in the field, the key really was, how do I do the pointer? Like that. The key really was this relationship. Yeah? The competitive, sometimes collaborative, sometimes competitive relationship between media organisations and practitioners on the one hand and political advocates on the other hand. able to talk about that in that way during the era of mass communication because the system was relatively stable and the dynamics were relatively fixed. And throughout most of the 20th century, on one hand, politicians and the media needed each other. Media organisations were needed by political advocates because of the mass audience they attracted. Media power arose from that capacity and the relations of credibility and trust established with audiences. Political advocates were needed by media organisations because who also competed with one another because they provide stories. Okay? Political power lay in their capacity to articulate the interests of large numbers of people and in mobilising mass social power. So in systems like ours, politicians were legitimated by the conduct of mass elections, obviously, and the media were legitimated by credibility, trust, authority that they established with their audiences. In the past, media and political organisations collaborated in generating political content and in setting agendas, particularly during the election, during elections. If those relationships didn't exist, and if there wasn't a commitment to managing conflict, then messages wouldn't get out to voters. But of course, conflicts were inevitable. The media and politicians competed for the control of political messages, and they kind of mutually adapted within the system with the purposes of controlling those messages. Political advocates responded to the unpredictability of journalism with strategies like stage media events, simplifying their message to meet the demands of changing standards of media coverage, and imposing strict itineraries during election campaigns to manage risk. And journalists chafed at that treatment and responded with their own adaptive tactics, like meta coverage, which is coverage of the media management itself, which you often see in election campaigns. Also so-called horse race coverage, which was just focused on contest and conflict, and also what's been called disdaining coverage, which expresses and perhaps encourages cynicism towards the political process. Anyway, that's the way it was. Just as an aside, in my opinion, one of the weaknesses perhaps in Lindsay Tanner's recent book is in not seeing this as a kind of dynamic interaction. He tends to place the blame there. He doesn't see that actually this is a case where people are adapting to one another, and institutions are adapting to one another. But look, this whole model is now basically an historical artefact. Things are a lot more complicated now. That's not to say that the mass media aren't still important. It's not to say that those relationships aren't still important. But things have changed, and that's not as a result of the uptake of social media as much as it is a result of the broader changes that the uptake of social media are a part of. There's a useful concept that a guy called Marcus Pryor came up with for a post-broadcast democracy. Okay? And he thinks that's what the phase we've entered in a lot of Western democracies. He's particularly focused on the US, but it's clearly adaptable to here. He developed it as a way of understanding the first and most obvious characteristic which is defining changes in political communication in Western democracies, and that is the fragmentation of shared media experience, leading to sharp differences in levels of engagement with politics. Okay? We can't assume that there is a mass audience for political material anymore. Okay? And people can, if they choose to, completely avoid any kind of political content. So there's a sharp divide between those who are inclined to seek it out and those who aren't. At the same time, those who do have an intrinsic interest in politics are able to consume more political content than ever. The immediate contrast here is with the high watermark of mass broadcasting in the 1970s and 1980s, when almost everyone absorbed at least some political information in a version of byproduct learning, and where television enlarged the audience for political communication by penetrating a sector of the electorate that was previously more difficult to reach and less heavily exposed to message flows. Now, the amount of political information you absorb depends on your existing preferences. Okay, and as Pryor says, to news junkies, politics has become a candy store. Others avoid news altogether. Political involvement has become more unequal and elections more polarised as a result. So television and the internet have delivered a more efficient media environment. The variety of information sources means that media diets can correspond more closely with your preferences. And you just may not like politics. If you don't, you can tune out. So Australian research mirrors international findings in showing that this is taking place. Sally Young's new book, which I'd recommend you all read, she says that while most Australians are interested in news, there's news and there's news. And the minority who mostly select, there's a minority who select those news sources with a high level of political content, as opposed to general news, which includes a large amount of non-political material. What she calls the most dedicated political junkies, who watch live broadcasts of parliamentary hearings or Question Time, specialist Sunday morning political television, or read news magazines, they're about 0.5% to 1% of the adult population. 2 to 5% listen to specialist political radio programming from public broadcasters, watch late night current affairs, or read broadsheet newspapers. At the outer limit, Young writes that around 10% watch news programming or major primetime current affairs programs on public broadcasters. So in Australia as elsewhere, those who are attentive to serious political media content cannot be considered as anything other than a niche audience. But it's not just about that fragmentation. The idea of post-broadcast should also be seen as a way of thinking about this era of read-write media. Those 1%ers, as we might call them, who are deeply committed to consuming political media, are now also obviously able to produce political content for themselves using social media, blogs, other self-publishing platforms. The people who formerly figured as citizens or the audience in those older understandings of political communication, they're not simply limited to writing letters to the editor or acting as the subjects of opinion polling. They can now be communicative actors. Oops. So there is a mass audience for political content anymore, and the audience is not passive, they are communicative and adaptive actors in that system now themselves. Okay, and some of them are using social media to voice new kinds of political demands. But social media has got a powerful lure for all of the actors in the political communication system, yeah? For the politicians, the journalists, and the citizens. It's got an obvious appeal for journalists. It offers an opportunity to communicate directly with the audience, to draw attention to their own work, to potentially increase their personal readership, and even to consolidate a personal brand. And we've got Australian journalists now talking about social media as a way of building a personal brand that you can take with you from employer to employer. For political advocates, it offers a new way to campaign where they can potentially bypass the media in sending out political messages. Particularly for lobby groups and minor parties who are not guaranteed the levels of media access that major parties receive as a matter of course, it offers the opportunity to make a connection with existing or potential supporters. Mostly existing though, probably. Most interestingly of all, perhaps, it offers new opportunities for the audience and citizens. It might not work this way forever, but at the moment... This is great. It may not work this way forever, but at the moment it's actually a place in which the audience can carry out its own adaptive strategies. During the election campaign in particular, it was a place where dissatisfaction with the coverage and the conduct of the election was voiced directly to journalists and politicians, which is where the conflict comes in. Now look, I don't want to be too apocalyptic about the election campaign. A lot of the complaints made about it we've heard before in relation to other elections, and here we are in a representative democracy that basically functions reasonably well most of the time. But it did exhibit some signs of a stalemate on several fronts. First of all, I guess there was a stalemate between the major parties. Don't want to be a glass half full guy, but you could say that both major parties lost, in effect. We can debate at that. In any case, it suggests that the major party was able to project a message that inspired voters to come over to their side in sufficient numbers to win. And I think both sides, both major parties, offered fairly risk-averse slogans and styles of campaigning. And you know, that's a kind of risk-averse campaigning is a kind of outcome in part of this kind of fragmentation as well. There were signs of a stalemate which may yet to be proved to be more crucial though, and that is in the competitive relationship between political advocates and the media. It seemed that for long stretches of the election campaign, the conflict between major media outlets and political actors became unmanageable, to the extent that both sides struggled to frame an agenda for the campaign or to guide public discussion. And you know, this is something that a couple of political communication scholars called Blumer and Gurevich wrote in 1995, but I think this is the feeling that a lot of people expressed in social media and elsewhere, a lot of citizens expressed about the way the campaign was conducted. Highly complex web of relationships grown up between politicians, their advisors and media professionals, which is so mutually preoccupying that the needs of ordinary citizens can fall far from sight. Okay, again, these complaints have been made for a while. I guess the difference in 2010, and it was radically different in my observation from 2007, was that citizens gave expression to the frustration that arises from that kind of feeling that their needs have fallen out of sight. Okay, some pretty striking manifestations of that then. The first is what I kind of call contested journalism. And I teach journalism students and I encourage them to think about how they will respond to this, because this is real, okay? The 1%ers who are deeply engaged with political media, who are also likely to be on Twitter, are able to directly confront journalists in a shared communicative space with what they see as the shortcomings of the work that they're doing. Fairly or unfairly, right or wrong, this is a kind of daily experience, okay, for a lot of working journalists, particularly in the national press. So what you find is that audiences are offering real-time criticism of agenda-setting activities and even questioning occasionally the truthfulness of campaign coverage. Journalists often responded to this necessarily. This involved a degree of conflict. What's striking to me is that in a space like Twitter, media professionals seem to feel bound to respond in a way that they never really did in relation to blogs. The key, perhaps, as I said, is that shared communicative space that both sides sort of value and want to be a part of. Once you're attacking agendas, maybe even truthfulness, you're attacking the kind of legitimacy of the media in our system. So that's something that people probably feel bound to respond to. Look, how individual journalists respond to that is, a matter for them. My suggestion to my students is that you take a breath and respond calmly and try to engage with people. I don't want to pick on Mark Colvin because he's actually an excellent user of Twitter and a really valuable person for a lot of people to follow. But he was just one of the first ones I found, and someone's had a go at him about something he's written, and he's called him a troll, and the guy's gotten back to him, and it's all gone on from there. There's a whole string in this conversation that I thought best not to show you, but this is the kind of thing that happens, right? Every day. Journalist is criticised, journalist makes a decision about how to respond, and in this case, it's a fairly snarky response. Okay? This is now commonplace. There are more exotic forms of attacks on journalists' legitimacy too, and like Twitter fakes. And I've written a paper on Twitter fakes, including fake Andrew Bolt, but this is just a kind of non-stop mockery, I suppose, of Bolt's positions. And whatever you think about the guy, this is something that he probably hasn't had to put up with before. Okay? And he actually reacted quite sharply to this on his blog at one point, to this account. So this kind of stuff is new, I guess. It's new for journalists to have to respond to direct criticism in this way. Okay, but politicians have to put up with it too. And what we saw, again, for want of a better term, is a kind of contested campaign in 2010. Research shows that the most highly engaged people, the 1%ers, as I keep talking about them, but they could be 5%ers, okay? The most highly engaged people, research has consistently shown that they tend to have partisan commitments. They tend to have political commitments. They're rarely neutral observers, okay? Now, what we find now is that campaign messaging can actually itself be disputed by these people on social media. Whether or not people have strong partisan commitments, they can disrupt campaign messaging, and often enough, you know, that kind of disruption can actually be reported on in the mainstream media and then, you know, refracted to a much wider audience in that way. Because Twitter increasingly is a source of news stories. Twitter can be used to mobilise interest groups among the highly engaged. It can be used to disrupt campaign messaging. It can be used for highly partisan counter messaging. And it is certainly a shared communicative space in which highly charged political debates take place between users. Okay, there's some just a sample of what some things people had said to Senator Bob Brown yesterday. Some of it's supportive. If you go through most politician streams, they're a little bit quite negative and you know, consists of attacks upon them. This is the AusPoll stream. If you ever want to have a look at this, the hashtag is AusPoll, and what you'll see there is basically a rolling debate between highly partisan although highly engaged people. Okay, a lot of people have talked about the internet and deliberative democracy. I think it's actually a lot more rough and tumble than that deliberative model can account for. Okay, just to finish off. In respect of the media and pop and political parties, there's obviously a kind of problem for them here that they have to deal with. Maybe we could sum it up. The great British cultural critic Raymond Williams once said, there are no masses, there are only ways of seeing people as masses. What's perhaps happening is that whereas both those institutions have derived their power from ways of seeing people as masses, it's very difficult to see people as masses now. Okay? It's not only media that are disaggregating, but the audiences as well. The mass audience is visibly falling apart into its component bits. Okay, so to finish off, to return to Brian McNair, you know, who offered us that model that I've been talking about, he, you know, is smart enough to realise that the old model of political communication is unsustainable, precisely because in his view, elites in the media and political institutions and organisations are losing control of the way information circulates. Now, it's a slow process. At the moment, it's around the edges, but it seems to be gathering speed. Social media is one expression of this kind of cultural chaos, and we can see there that information flows too quickly from too many sources for those who used to discipline the process of political communication to keep up. Fragmentation is another expression of this chaos. There is no stable audience we can presume to speak to, and very little we can assume about the way in which they might reply. So how should practitioners of media and politics respond to the current situation? The short answer is I don't know. On the one hand, a sizeable minority of the electorate is switched off from politics altogether. Okay, we know that. We know that there's also a vocal, polarised minority that is intensely engaged. How do we put out messages that reach and persuade both groups, as well as the sizeable group in the middle, who exist as monitorial citizens? Yeah, they tune in when there's a problem or a major decision to be made, like voting. And, you know, on the other hand, a part of this fragmented audience are now able to circulate their own political messages and are willing and able to contest campaigning and coverage. Oftentimes, they are predisposed to be cynical in regard to politicians and journalists. They also provide information for one another. They're fairly unresponsive to attempts at message control. All of this constitutes a significant dilemma that goes to the heart of conducting politics and elections in liberal democracies in their current forms. So I look forward to seeing how you solve it. Thanks.
We might have time for one or two questions or comments that gives a different perspective. Well, I'll ask a question. Then you talk about the change in the one percenters.
Yeah.
And the power, presuming that will grow. I guess one of the questions that I have been on occasion the recipient of many emails on a particular topic, you know, at one stage last year I had 9,000 emails in 24 hours on a particular issue.
That must have been intensely pleasurable.
Do you think that really strengthens the message of the the small group that are seeking to...
So the campaign group gets all its members to send...
Possibly only five members, but they send a lot of emails.
Yeah. Look, I'm not sure. I mean, that would be a question for those of you who have to field those emails. I doubt that that's a substantially effective way of conducting campaigns, if that's relentlessly your strategy. The point is, I suppose, that with those kind of tactics, which are easily available, which are cheap, but with an action that's easily reproducible, you can tie someone down having to deal with 9,000 emails, can't you? Those kinds of tactics, I mean, we see something obviously on a different order, but something similar with a group like Anonymous who launch direct and denial of service attacks on major kind of institutions that goes beyond the kind of nuisance value maybe of an email campaign, but it's the same kind of strategy, and it's becoming increasingly common, I suppose. The one that's based on nuisance value and on crippling certain parts of an organisation. Is that legitimate political discourse? John, what do you think?
Hi, do you see the media as playing a fairly major role with influencing policy and taking stands on certain issues? I know they will probably always have, but I mean, now do you think that political parties are taking too much notice of the media, and maybe the media have more of a forum now to sort of push their agenda and push their views onto the community?
I suppose one of the founding propositions of the discipline I work in, political I work where political communication and digital media intersect. That's where all my research is. I suppose one of the founding propositions of political communication is that the media have moved closer to the centre of the political process. And, that's an ongoing kind of thing. But the media itself is changing, I suppose, is what I was trying to say today. The structure of how information flows throughout, our political culture is changing. I think when it comes to sort of issue agendas, I'm still kind of committed to the idea that a lot of the time it's a collaborative process. I mean, think about a press conference and the political messages that emerge from that. That's something that is collaboratively done between the media, the political media and political advocates, okay? There's still a lot of that, okay? But now, around the edges, there's this kind of uncontrollable, in a sense, flow of information that these people who've been institutions that have been accustomed to controlling stuff can't control, and that's new. That's interesting.
Do swing voters actually consume media? I mean, this is, I guess, is a question for both of you, and I understand it's a bit of a problem getting demographics on them.
Mm-hmm.
But to what extent does all of the coverage, all of the blogs, all of the outrage, whether convicted or not, actually influence a change and a result in an election?
I think, there's probably a Venn diagram which contains swing voters, and there will be principled swing voters who genuinely do, are good liberal citizens who tune in to political messages and carefully weigh up their voting decision. Okay, but there's probably a Venn diagram where the undecided voter, that sample overlaps with people who are pretty much tuned out. And that's who, I suppose, a lot of really simplistic, not necessarily bad simplistic, but simplistic messages which are designed to capture people's attention as much as anything are directed at that particular segment. And I think it's probably a larger segment than we like to think it is. International research suggests that, that's quite large and it's growing, because people have the opportunity now to avoid political content altogether. How do you reach them? Go on Sunrise, maybe. No, seriously, I mean, that's a perfectly logical strategy in an environment where people, how else are you going to get to them?
Did you want to?
I think that's most of it. I mean, you mentioned before, the swing voter. I think the concept of monitory democracy is an interesting one. John Keane's written about it. that a lot of citizens, a small number, are highly active, but don't dismiss the rest. And he talks about the monitorial citizen or monitory democracy, where most of us sit back and just keep an eye on things, and we're happy to let the journos and the politicians run the country or think they do and just get on with it, but we monitor. And I think social media is used for that, and it's hard to see those people because they are lurkers. They don't necessarily comment or post, but they are watching and they are listening. And I think we don't know enough yet about the monitory approach of democracy, where citizens will stay inactive, but they're watching, they're listening and learning, and it does inform them, and it may affect their vote, but it's invisible to us. And every now and again we see it, where we just see a massive swing against a government. Mm-hmm. Somebody's been listening to something out there. They're not as inert as we sometimes think. So.
One last question.
So do we know if these digital medium are engaging people who wouldn't otherwise be engaged in politics? Because obviously you've got a lot of people who are disengaged in politics, and if they don't watch TV and so on, and don't read about politics in the newspapers, listen to it on the radio, is it just the people who are already interested in politics getting following politics and social media, or is it people who otherwise wouldn't be interested?
Well, look, I've called, I mean, in my research on fakers, on people who are faking politicians and journalists on Twitter, I mean, I've called it a kind of a fan community. You know, the people who are highly engaged with politics or follow everything, look, they're kind of like Buffy fans or, you know, fans of other kinds of media product, in a sense. I mean, you know, there may be better social, there might be broader social goods that emerge from their fandom that are different to, you know, but essentially, but I wouldn't dismiss, you know, there is social media, there is social media. There are people getting, following links on their Facebook feed, you know, to issues, to stories that they won't have seen otherwise, just because one of their Facebook friends is into politics.
The media is, increasingly the media is integrated. So what's what? Someone is not reading newspapers, but they get a Facebook link or a Bitly link on Twitter, they follow it and it links to a newspaper article. So they've consumed a newspaper article, but they would never read a newspaper, but they've done it via social media.
Yeah.
I think the answer to your question is yes and no. There's no question there's a concern about digital enclaves, echo chambers, there's different words used for it, where people cluster, like-minded citizens, they're already active and they just activated a new place. But we saw in the Obama campaign, we saw the biggest voter turnout since 1968. Yeah. Now, the main difference was social media. So it may not have changed how they vote. Going back to an earlier question to me, does it change their vote? We don't know, but it at least got them to turn out. At least it got them to vote and take some interest. So yes, it's increasing people's interest. Is it changing ultimately behavior? We don't know. But I think you've got to increasingly see media as a media ecology, as a complete environment. And people will go backwards. And in the end of the day, the words television, radio are antiquated. You won't know what it is. You'll watch a video on YouTube that could have been a TV broadcast, and you'll watch it in a newspaper that ain't news and ain't paper.
I think so
it's integrated.
In relation to television, as I was saying earlier, they used to talk about byproduct learning, which is, you know, back in the 70s, when all the news was on at the same time, they had this roadblock. Your choice was to watch the news on one channel or another, or turn the TV off, okay? Most people watch the news, they call that byproduct learning, where people just absorb a certain amount of political information. I suspect there's a kind of byproduct learning happening on social media. I suspect it's going to be very hard for us to empirically measure how that happens, and it will have to be quite a subtle methodology that looks into that. But I suspect that people are being exposed to political information via especially Facebook walls, and it'd be interesting to see what the scope of that is.
We might bring that to an end, because I think we've run out of time. We've come a long way from the time 50 years ago, 60 years ago, that politicians went out on the back of trucks and spoke to local communities. It was a different sort of byproduct learning. And I think we're still at early stages of assessing the impact of social media on the broader community, particularly in a really robust democracy like Australia, where people have views and they want to share them. I'm not sure sometimes they're that worried about who they're sharing them with, but it does create a whole new environment for us. So I'd like to thank our speakers again, and thank you for all turning up. So good, thank you. We'll have one more presentation on this team next week. between today, Peter Chen, in the same room at the same time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
The election stuff is just about the amount of media and attention. And the online consultation was in the Australian Journal of Political Science.
Some structural
change. I can't think of where, 2010.
Yeah,
I'm absolutely fascinated. I mean, the one I have different views to some who have studied media history, and actually, I don't think it's anything new. I think mass media was an aberration. We thought it was such a high handful of actors, areas of the center, like that model to show. But communication's always been a messy, disruptive, raucous thing. I think before social media was the first hand. I know it's incredible. Someone saying, oh, yeah, I'll have to say.